Major escalation or parting shot? 9 weeks before Joe Biden hands the reins back to his predecessor, the U.S. president approving Ukraine's use of American-made long-range missiles inside of Russian territory. The move's in response to Moscow's deployment of North Korean troops to the frontline Kursk region. Are the missiles only for that border region? What happens after Donald Trump is sworn in on January 20th? On the eve of the U.S. decision, Ukraine's president conceding as his army loses ground that 2025 will be the year his country sits down at the bargaining table. With a NATO skeptic Trump on his way, what will the next weeks change? And will the likes of France and the UK continue to strictly follow the U.S.'s lead on use of long-range weaponry? Europe's far, very far from its own strategic autonomy that's been espoused by Emmanuel Macron. And then there's the Kremlin, which warns against a rise in tension, a familiar refrain each time the West has crossed its red lines in Ukraine. Will this time, though, be different? Today in the France 24 debate, we're asking about Biden's parting shot. And with us from Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, political scientist Peter Zamayev, director of the Eurasia Democracy Initiative. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, sure.
From former NATO political officer Samantha de Benzer and his associate fellow at the think tank Chatham House. Good to see you.
Good evening.
From Berlin, Henning Hoff, executive director of International Politique Quarterly. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
And from Washington, he's a U.S. Army veteran and historian. James J. Carafano is the E.W. Richardson Fellow at the Heritage Foundation think tank. Good to see you.
Yeah, bonjour.
Your reactions on the hashtag F24 debate. Yeah, Joe Biden himself yet to comment on a move that Kyiv had long been pleading for and whose specifics remain largely under wraps. Morgan Eyre has the story.
Ukraine has been lobbying Washington for years to be able to use American weapons to strike further inside Russia. Finally, it seems the U.S. has given Kyiv a green light. The New York Times and other media report that information based on comments from U.S. officials. The missiles are known as the Army Tactical Missile Systems, or ATACMS. They have a maximum range of 300 kilometers and can reach further into Russian territory than other weapons in the Ukrainian arsenal. American officials suggest it's likely they will be used in Russia's Kursk region. This would bolster Ukraine against Russian and North Korean troops. President Vladimir Putin previously said that such a step would mean the direct involvement of NATO countries in the war. President Volodymyr Zelensky did not confirm nor deny they were granted approval for these long-range missiles to strike inside Russia.
Today, there's a lot of talk in the media about us receiving permission for respective actions. But strikes are not carried out with words. Such things are not announced. Missiles will speak for themselves. They certainly will.
It's been suggested by experts and the media that Moscow will have already begun moving some of its resources outside of the Kursk region in anticipation of the decision. Some experts believe while it will aid Kyiv, it's not going to tilt the balance significantly.
I think this will certainly help the Ukrainians, but I don't think it's going to be decisive for the direction of the war. My guess is that the Biden administration wants Putin and he wants the North Koreans to understand that there are costs to escalation.
It comes, too, as Russian forces advance steadily in the east of Ukraine and with Donald Trump's return to the White House raising fears of the future of U.S. support for Kyiv.
Peter Zamayev, where you are in the Ukrainian capital, what are the reactions?
Well, the reactions are Ukrainians want revenge, obviously. We are very much deep in this cycle of strikes and desire for retribution. Just as we speak, rescuers are trying to dig out those who have remained alive from the strike at Odessa. 10 people dead there. You're seeing it on your screens right now. 10 dead earlier in the city of Sumy. So naturally, Ukrainians welcome these news. They are, as always, we've seen during this war, a day late and a dollar short. Unfortunately, we're still not clear as to whether this Permission will be limited to Kursk. How many of these long-range missiles we actually have? Whether Germany and Britain and France will follow up with their signing off on their scalps, respectively, and Storm Shadows. It was reported that they did almost automatically. Now that's being taken back. So there's a lot of uncertainty. Unfortunately, we've seen throughout this war, you know, we go from one Wunderwaffe, one miracle weapon expectation to another. And unfortunately, that has not changed the situation on the ground, as Zelensky himself, you reported that, has said. Russians are gaining. They're gaining pretty quickly. They have, just this year, they've gained more territory than Ukraine did during its counteroffensive. So the situation is pretty grim. I cannot put it any other way. But once again, any news now, right now, is welcome news. So now we're holding our breath for what these strikes, when these strikes happen, what they're going to target. We'll see.
Yeah, Samantha DeBinder, there was this, just first of all, unpacking the way it's been announced through statements that have been made to several media outlets, including the French news agency, AFP, the New York Times, and others. Is this logical? And yeah, as you heard there, Peter saying, the French and the British keep playing their cards close to their chest. This is all part of the plan. You don't announce... You don't hold a big press conference of world leaders to announce airstrikes?
Well, I don't know what the plan is, but if I were one of the planners, I would certainly want to keep as much as possible under wraps, for the simple reason that you have to keep the Russians guessing as to what is going to be done or not. Because these missiles have a limited range. You know, there's a lot of noise has been made out of them, but they have a range between 250 and 300 kilometers. So the Russians will... They can't move all their hardware beyond the range of a strike of those missiles, but they can move a lot. So the more uncertainty there is, the more room there is for when those missiles to actually be used and the green light to be given for them to actually do what they're supposed to do, which is take out some of the Russian military, whether it's the planes or the rocket launchers that are causing the destruction that we're seeing in Ukraine. So I would think that it's actually a very good thing that there's a lot of fog of war around this announcement.
James J. Carafano, if you were a general on the battlefield, what would you use these longer-range missiles for?
Yeah, first of all, I have to say, I actually played a small role in the development and building of ATACMS, and I'm really proud of this system. So these are targets, these are weapons that can basically flatten relatively soft things in a modestly large area. So, for example, if you had a large troop concentration and you dropped a couple of these, it would be devastating. A command and control facility, certainly radars and air defense systems. And this gets to the real value of ATACMS. It's not really designed as a revenge weapon. It's designed as a long-range weapon that allows you to do other things. And so if you're looking at it from a military perspective, what you would do is you might strike an ATACMS on a radar facility and you're saying, oh, well, that's not all that impressive. But that might open up a whole wide area where you could send in a bunch of attack drones and they could be really quite devastating. So I think we have to look at the complementary nature of what they might hit versus that them as a single destructive weapon.
What do you make of the timing?
Well, to me, it really befrets, and, you know, I just say this, I don't represent the president-elect, and I'm not on the transition from this time, so I'm not speaking for the president. I think it really reflects that this is the befret, that the U.S. doesn't really have a strategy. This is not, there's what's changed in the strategic situation that would lead the United States to make this call, and the answer is nothing. So the only thing we can assume is this was a political decision, that Biden wanted this off the table during the election because he didn't want it to impact the election in a negative way, and that he's only doing it now because he's not up for election anymore.
Well, the Americans saying that it's because of the presence of those North Korean troops.
Yeah, I think that's pretty fatuous. I mean, so far there's enough North Korean troops there for a week's worth of casualties. So somehow that's changed the strategic situation, or that this is a punishment for the Russians. I don't know. But here's what I would say is there's a presumption that somehow President Trump would oppose this. I'm not sure that's correct. President Trump wants to end the conflict. if you want to end the conflict, you have to enter into negotiations with Putin from the strongest position possible. And I think Trump would actually appreciate the Ukrainians being as successful as possible before he got into office. But I do take the point that was made earlier in the show. These are not game changers. It's not going to change everything on the battlefield. On the other hand, it is going to make life tougher for the Russians.
Henning Hoff, do you agree?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was a timely or rather very late decision to take. I mean, we've been discussing it for months on end. It's interesting. I think this argument being put forward that it is a reaction to the North Koreans' presence in fighting an active war in Europe. And if you have observed the reactions from European capitals over the last couple of days and weeks, there was no reaction whatsoever to this very or very little reaction, at least, to this very, very, very big escalation which we have seen on the battlefield. So I think it's good that this decision has finally been taken. If that is what is happening, we're still waiting for the Biden administration to actually confirm it. But it is a good move, I think.
All right, reactions from Moscow, as outlined at the outset by Peter Zamayev, coming in two forms. First of all, Moscow's forces continuing to make inroads in the eastern Donbas region, and this steady diet of attacks against civilians and critical infrastructure, which continues. There you can see the map of the front line as it stands now inside of Ukraine. At least 10 killed this Monday in the southern Black Sea port of Odessa. Russian strikes forcing rolling power outages and the use of backup generators. It's the second time in as many days that Odessa has been hit. And there you see some of the images. Again, this is from earlier in the day. And this is on top of the 11 killed in the northeastern city of Sumy near the Russian border, including two children on Sunday. There are other strikes elsewhere. Meanwhile, well, it's also a war of words coming from the Kremlin.
It's obvious that the outgoing administration in Washington intends to take steps and that they've been talking about this. To continue adding fuel to the fire and provoking further escalation of tensions around this conflict.
There's been plenty of saber-rattling, Samantha De Bender, and people take it seriously. Russia's a nuclear power, so you can't just dismiss it out of hand, or can you?
Well, it has been taken seriously, and the proof of this is that the United States has withheld the permission to use some of their missiles, including the French and British ones, in strikes into Russia because of the constant saber-rattling from Russia. I just want to really point something out. You mentioned the strikes that took place in Ukraine, particularly the ones over the weekend. Now, this weekend saw the largest attack, aerial attack, on Ukraine since the beginning of the all-out war in February 2022. That came after the conversation between Vladimir Putin and Chancellor Scholz, after a conversation which was supposed to show, from the German point of view at least, a will to encourage negotiations. I mean, although the reports from the conversation are that Scholz was quite tough, it was an opening towards Putin. It has been perceived by the Russians as an opening. What is the reaction to that opening? Absolute massive attack on Ukraine, on Ukrainian cities, and on Ukrainian energy infrastructure.
So you think that, more than the North Koreans, might have been the trigger for this announcement out of Washington?
I think it was probably both. There has been so much criticism of the lack of reaction from the West to the presence of North Koreans on what is de facto European soil, and the threat of involving North Korea even more into this war, that I think that was that. I also think it was President Biden wanting to have a parting shot, wanting to show, okay, I did actually do something to help Ukraine. And it was also done at a time when any potential retaliation from Russia will probably be mitigated by the fact that Russia knows that in 2 months' time, President Putin's basically friend will be in the White House. So I doubt very much Putin is going to risk annihilation when he believes, at least, that in 2 months' time, there will be someone in the White House who might calm things down from his point of view.
All right. The strongest reaction, not from Moscow, but out of Pyongyang, Kim Jong-un stating that Washington's continuing military assistance to Ukraine, quote, raises the concern of World War III, adding his country would bolster its nuclear weapons defense without a limit. Peter Zalmayev, again, I get back to the apprehensions that the rest of the planet feels watching this show, particularly when you know that Russians have designs to make a move for Zaporizhia, which is next to Europe's largest nuclear power plant. What can you say about the reactions we're hearing from Ukraine's enemies?
Well, you know, when you talk about Ukraine's enemies, you also have to talk about these gray zones and these players that it's hard to categorize who they are. You just quoted Kim Jong-un, but then Peter Szijjártó, who is Viktor Orban's foreign minister of Hungary, said the exact same thing. He said that you have this warmongering faction that's outgoing, that is going against the will of the people that supposedly voted for Donald Trump and all of his agenda items and some of his team players' agenda items, such as J.D. Vance, who has essentially provided Ukraine with an option of instead of a security guarantee, a guarantee of Ukraine's defenselessness to Russia. You know, Ukraine cedes its territory, Ukraine gives up on its army, essentially a hybrid of the Belarus and the Georgian scenario. So no real army to speak of, then eventual elections that would propel to power pro-Kremlin politicians. So this is exactly what we're dealing with. And so you have a chorus of these players, and some of them are European politicians. You have to start questioning yourself what they're doing inside the European Union. They are in chorus repeating Kremlin's line from the very beginning of this war. Remember, Putin threatened nuclear annihilation, essentially, of the world should the West step in. Well, that hasn't happened, and two can play this game. When you mention Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, there is a Kursk nuclear power plant, and it is going to be very much within the range of these ATACMS missiles. That is causing the Kremlin to lose some sleep, I'm sure.
James J. Carafano, can you put Peter's mind at ease on this?
Yeah, I don't know. But look, first of all, I completely reject the notion that somehow Trump is Putin's friend. Nobody in the United States really believes this, who looks seriously at policy. Nobody in the Kremlin really believes this. Somehow there's some kind of special relationship, and we just ignore everything that happened the first term where we clearly were not Russia's friend. So I just reject that out of hand. And look, Ukraine was not even a top 20 issue in the U.S. election. So somehow there's a mandate for the United States to walk away from Ukraine. I reject that. The first thing I would say is Afghanistan. Biden was completely humiliated when he walked in the door and he made an initiative in Afghanistan. And he turned the country over and it plagued him for 4 years. Donald Trump is a lot of things, but he's not stupid. He's not going to walk in the door, make a horrible deal with the Russians, and be humiliated for the next 4 years.
But you heard Peter Zalmayev quoting there his running mate, and you've also seen the remarks from Tulsi Gabbard.
If you actually listen, if you actually look at that, first of all, the position is basically a frozen conflict. And I don't think I've been in many European capitals. I talked to mere Europeans, and I think they acknowledge too that the way forward is going to be a frozen conflict. So I don't think there's anything really, really unique there.
I'm just very surprised at this. When Trump's potential director of national intelligence is hailed on Russian television as potentially being a Russian agent, it's on a talk show, it's not official, this is not an official line, but we know how well the Russian television is controlled.
And you know it's nonsense. She's not a Russian agent. There's no evidence she was ever a Russian agent. The head of the DIA, who's Ratcliffe, used to be the DNI. He is solidly anti-Russian. He's one of Trump's closest advisors. So we can always pick the fear-mongering stuff we want to listen to. But the reality is there is no appointment in this administration that suggests that the United States is going to abandon Ukraine or leave NATO. This is just mythical. Trump wants a win, and he wants a win through strength. I think what we're seeing here on the Russian part is actually an acknowledgement of things. Nothing the Russians are doing right now is strategic. All of these operations are really designed to make the Russians look as strong as possible because they sense this is coming. And if there's a negotiation, they want to be in as strong a position as possible, just like the Ukrainians want to be in as strong a position as possible. That's where we are right now. We're headed to a frozen.
Let's look at some of the other reactions from three key players. The French and the British, they also make long-range missiles for use inside of Ukraine. They also have put the same limitations and said they would follow Washington's lead. They jointly make what they call here, I'm drawing a blank.
The storm shadows, what they call them in Britain.
Scalp, that's it. Scalps are what they call them here in France. They have a slightly shorter range than the ATACMS, 250 kilometers as opposed to 300. Here's what President Macron said at the G20 summit in Rio when he arrived.
I believe that today, if we need to know what Mr. Putin's intentions are, what he has just done on the ground is a clear sign of them. Whatever his declarations, he does not want peace and is not ready to negotiate it. And I believe that it is the duty of all of us to really push Russia to stop fighting and negotiate peace on terms that respect international law.
All right, and turning Samantha de Bendern's head across the Rhine with Putin, that one-hour phone call last Friday with the German Chancellor, Olaf Scholz, conceding that Russia's subsequent bombing of civilians over the weekend proves Vladimir Putin's in bad faith.
Das Gespräch war...
The conversation was very detailed, but led to the conclusion that the Russian president's views on this war have not changed, which is not good news. In my view, it would not be a good idea for there to be talks between the American president and the Russian president in the near future, and for the leader of an important European country not to hold talks himself. There may be some in Germany who think that's a good idea. I'm not one of them.
Now, Henning Hoff, why that matters is because Germany produces Taurus missiles. And this Monday, again, the German Defense Ministry stating that it won't be sending any to Ukraine anytime soon. It is sending 4,000 long-range drones that are powered by artificial intelligence. Do you take Scholz's point that we heard in that clip that Trump is coming and so he can't be the only one speaking with Putin?
Yeah, I think so. I think this is one of the motivations that brought Chancellor Scholz to pursue this phone call. He has been criticized for it quite widely, and I think to some extent also rightly. He has isolated Germany on this question. We have heard sort of statements from the French, also from the Polish, from politicians from the Baltic states. So it's for Scholz, it was not a sort of very very good move. He has again been shown as someone who acts not very well coordinated with his allies. Nonetheless, there's sort of, I think, this idea of making sure that the Europeans somehow will be sitting at the table if and when the next president, U.S. president, meets with Vladimir Putin.
And
this is one element of it.
Yeah, and right now you have a ruling Social Democratic Party where there are... two figures at the top, one who's going to be running in snap elections for chancellor again, Olaf Scholz. There's another one in the wings, the defense minister, Boris Pistorius, who's more hawkish. Public opinion's on whose side? Is public opinion where you are more on Scholz's side or more on Pistorius's side?
Well, the polls are pretty clear. Pistorius is by far the more preferred and candidate, if you ask voters at large. Within the SPD, even there are sort of SPD voters say, well, they would prefer Pistorius to Scholz. But the practicalities of changing the candidate would be quite a stretch for the Social Democrats. So if you have a chancellor in office who wants to run again, it would be a very difficult feat to unseat him in this procedure.
Because explain to us about the Taurus missiles. Is Scholz's decision to hold off on them popular in Germany?
I think that there's a sizable minority. I think it's a minority view that it's wise of Scholz not to escalate in that way. There's also this question of are we then becoming a party to this war because of this highly complex sort of target programming which is involved using the Taurus? This, at least for a long time, was the reason that was given to us journalists, that this is sort of really behind Scholz's decision, that the Ukrainians basically wouldn't be able to do it on their own, and this would sort of then require an involvement by Germany in some, to some extent. I wasn't always very sure that this is a really convincing argument, but it's partly what has informed Scholz's position. He is so clear now on not sending Taurus that this is this will not change until the next election coming in 23rd of February.
All right, and of course, not everyone's a fan of talking to Putin. Case in point, the president of Poland.
Russia
brutally attacks Ukraine, and one of the leaders of the free worlds, one of the leaders of the Western countries, a great European country, the strongest economy in Europe, is holding talks with the aggressor. You know well, I absolutely think that this was a mistake from such an international political side. And if someone here is pursuing some interests, it gives the impression as if the German Chancellor is pursuing only German interests, or trying to pursue only vested interests, German interests, perhaps at the expense of other partners, perhaps at the expense of other countries, first of all Ukraine, but also the countries of Central Europe.
And I could play for you, Samantha Debender, in the clip of the Slovakian Prime Minister, which is the 180-degree opposite of what you heard there from Andrzej Duda.
I thought we were going to play.
No.
Yeah, so you have two countries in Eastern Europe, Hungary and Slovakia, who have at their head people who are very clearly pro-Putin and pro-Russia. Now, regarding the German position, what's interesting to note is that as amongst the potential chancellors, there is the head of the CDU, who really is actually in favor of the Taurus being given to Ukraine. And I just want to remind people that the Taurus has a 500-kilometer range, which is even more than the missiles that we're talking about today. But what the optics are what count here. And everybody who knows Putin well, particularly those who were part of the Warsaw Pact and who've been treating with Russia for many years, know that Russia only understands one thing, that is the language of strength and the language of force. The Poles understand that. Orbán's relationship with Putin is also something that has come under a lot of scrutiny as to what potential common vested interests that they would have, and they're not the good, certainly in Orbán's, from Orbán's point of view. There are a lot of financial issues potential issues on what's called compromat between Putin and Orbán. So those who want to fight Russia and who understand Putin know there's only one language that works, and that is the language of strength. That doesn't mean that you can't talk to him, but you can talk to him when there's a position on what is needed to do, what the Europeans plan to do to end this war. Scholz also angered the Ukrainians with his phone call, because he did apparently coordinate it with the G7 partners, but not with President Zelensky. So when Scholz, after his phone call, says, well, we do not want to do anything behind Ukraine's back, but then has this phone call with Putin behind Ukraine's back, again, the optics of this are very bad, also considering the fact that Germany is the biggest European donor of weapons to Ukraine, which, again, creates very mixed messages. And Putin can then say to his own people, well, look, our European allies are divided, and that is what he wants more than anything else.
James J. Carafano, you heard Henning Hoff there saying that don't expect the Germans to change their mind ahead of those February snap elections. What do you think of Chancellor Scholz's caution?
Well, I actually think Trump would be not a fan of it, because, again, I think Trump wants to enter a negotiation from the strongest position possible. And I think the criticisms of the chancellor are well taken. I would say my assessment is that his position is basically on domestic German politics, and again, not a strategic decision. The notion on targeting doesn't seem really realistic to me, because the United States can do the targeting at depth in Russia, and they can give it to anybody they want. So the fact that they could only get targeting data from the Germans for a 500K strike, to me, doesn't seem very credible.
Peter Zamayev, just a final word on this issue of talking or not with Putin. We all know there are back-channel negotiations that are taking place, proof being regularly there are prisoner swaps between the two sides. Is it so shocking to speak with Vladimir Putin?
Well, listen, something to be said about President Zelensky's reaction to Scholz's decision to talk to Putin. Zelensky was incensed, and it's been sort of the pattern before. Ukrainian diplomats have complained about other issues similar to that. My position is that the German chancellor has the sovereign right of a sovereign country, as a leader of a sovereign country, to speak to whoever he wants to, whether that's helpful or not. And I think the speaker in the studio put it very well, that it sends a mixed message. Yes, you have to negotiate with Putin with as much strength as possible. That's why this decision may come in handy. I would take issue with James of the Heritage Foundation when he keeps talking about the frozen conflict in 2025. Well, I just don't see that. I mean, Russia is winning quite convincingly once again the Donbass. There's no motivation for Putin to be freezing this conflict for as long as this encroachment on Ukrainian territory continues to happen. And that's why I think that, in a way, what Putin is doing, he's escalating these launches of massive, massive artillery and missile barrages on Ukraine territory. I think this actually plays into his view of what Trump will do and JD Vance when they said we have to stop this war at any cost. They will say, look, blood continues to spill. There's no end in sight. We have to end it at any cost. And that's also could be part of Putin's plan for the incoming administration.
James J. Carafano, you take the point. I mean, did Donald Trump send too many mixed messages himself on the campaign trail? He certainly didn't talk about bargaining from a position of strength.
I would disagree. So, look, I agree with everybody that said you have to negotiate with Putin from a position of strength. Otherwise, you're not going to be successful. I think that's common knowledge here. I think it's common knowledge with the president. So here's the deal. If Trump wants to make a deal. He likes making deals. He doesn't like making bad deals. So there have to be consequences on the table for turning the deal down, which means he has to convince the Russians that if they don't take a deal now, that what he will give the Ukrainians will put them in a worse position strategically. Otherwise, it's not worth even putting a deal on the table. Why would Putin want to do any deal? I agree that only Putin can end this war and only he can do a deal. But I would look at the evidence we have now, and to me, I would say it's just as much Putin trying to get in a position to be strong to cut a deal in 2025 as it is thinking that he's going to walk across the border and be waving in Poland.
All right. We talked about the August incursion into Russia's Kursk region. It's a bit of an outlier in a year where Ukraine's forces have been, as Peter was saying, on the back foot. This Monday, Volodymyr Zelensky visiting with troops near the front lines in several places, including the eastern city of Pokrovsk. In a weekend interview, Ukraine's president conceding again that 2025 will be a year of negotiations.
I think the war will end, and not in the abstract. There is no exact date, but with the policy of the team that will now be leading the White House, the war will end faster. This is their approach, the promise to their country. And for them, it is also very important.
Peter Zamayev, can you interpret those words for us, the war will end? What does he mean?
I think he's finally coming to realize that you need to open up to the Ukrainian people. We've lived in this sort of informational bubble for the past 2.5 years, where obviously falling far short of Russia's propaganda. People have been sort of spoon-fed this idea that Ukrainians are on the attack, everything is well, the West is with us till the very end, and you cannot continue to deny reality that not only is the Western coalition fickle, not only is Donald Trump still, as we say, a dark horse. We don't know his intentions while in office in a couple of months. But also, once again, our mobilization efforts in Ukraine have pretty much failed. I have to be honest about that. And there's something that I think Zelensky is realizing. You have to be upfront with the Ukrainians, who are now seeing that what they're seeing on TV contrasts with the reality on the ground.
Samantha de Benen.
Yeah, listening to Zelensky's interview, one thing that I found was really important. He said that partners, and particularly the United States, who will participate in these negotiations, can't see themselves as mediators. They are party to this conflict. They are on the side of Ukraine. And it seems as though Zelensky is concerned that the allies will try and somehow be neutral in any potential negotiations. And that comes from what he's seeing come out of Donald Trump's rhetoric. And I would just like to say that there is a reason why people have this perception that Donald Trump is closer to Putin and would not like, and is not so much of a Ukraine fan, is what Donald Trump himself says, not what people imagine he's saying. It's his refusal during the debate with Kamala Harris to come out firmly in favor of Ukraine. It's his choice of vice president, who says basically Ukraine is not important. And it's his choice of head of intelligence who just parrots what the Russians say about the causes of war in Ukraine. Now, maybe, you know, it's weird to interpret this as having more of a pro-Russian stance. I'm just basing myself not on the conspiracy theories or the intelligence reports by former intelligence officers who have talked about Trump's link to Putin. I'm talking about what he has himself said. When he himself has talked about, you know, maybe saying to Russia they can attack NATO if NATO doesn't pay, that does not, it doesn't take a leap of imagination to think that Trump has an issue with both with NATO and Trump might not be Ukraine's friend, based on what Trump himself has said and nothing more.
Let me ask you, James J. Carafano, because we saw Donald Trump with that Putin-friendly pick to head U.S. intelligence services, that former Hawaii congressman, Tulsi Gabbard.
I reject the notion that this person is a Putin-friendly pick. I just reject that. So thank you. And again, we don't talk about the CIA director, who is very firmly anti-Russian and, again, an incredibly close advisor and a real national security professional.
All right, we saw on Saturday evening Donald Trump with Tulsi Gabbard at Madison Square Garden there for a UFC fight. But most important was the man sitting next to him, which is Elon Musk. And we see Elon Musk's Twitter feed, which is a lot of times calling for Ukraine to make concessions. And is Musk a worry for you?
No. I mean, everybody can cherry pick this to death and pick all kinds of data points which fulfill this kind of fantasy in their head. Donald Trump was very firm for 4 years. Donald Trump was the first world leader who actually gave weapons to Ukraine that actually enabled him to survive the opening months of the war. He was the guy who said Nord Stream 2 was a bad idea. He is the guy that stiff-armed Putin for 4 years. He is the guy that during the presidential election, when the big Ukraine aid package came up, if he thought it was to his advantage and that was his position, he could have told Republicans not to vote for that package, and he said nothing, and that package went through. He is the guy who sat down with Zelensky, and after talking to him, Zelensky was the guy who came out and said, I'm looking forward to this administration because I think they're going to be a strong partner for me. So again, I think this cherry picking is absolute nonsense and completely destructive to have the Donald Trump that's in your head as opposed to the one that's very likely to be president, because it's in America's interest not to leave NATO, and it's in America's interest not to see Putin running Kyiv. And I think both of those things, no American president's going to stand for, no matter who had won the election.
Henning Hoff, is that how people in Berlin see it? Nope, we seem to be having audio issues with Berlin. We'll try to reconnect. Henning, can you hear us? All right, we'll try to reconnect in a moment there. Apologies for that. Samantha de Benen?
No, well, regarding the aid package to Ukraine that was consistently blocked in Congress by the Republicans, and that has had catastrophic consequences on the battlefield, direct, tangible consequences in terms of loss of land and loss of personnel. So, you know, I would love to be wrong. I would love to come here in 6 months' time and say, listen, I was absolutely wrong about Donald Trump. He's done everything he can to make sure Ukraine is able to survive as a sovereign state. He said he would get the war over in 24 hours, even before he became president. Well, it's been 2 weeks now. The war is still not over. okay, you know, one can't always keep all one's campaign promises. And luckily for the Ukrainians now, they have been given a green light to use some of these long-range missiles inside Russian territory.
All right, the connection is back with Berlin. Henninghoff, apologies for that. How do people where you're sitting see Trump's return to the White House when it comes to NATO, when it comes to Ukraine?
Well, with trepidation, I think the thing about the incoming Trump administration and Mr. Trump personally is that no one really knows what he's going to do. And maybe including Mr. Trump himself. So this creates this big moment of uncertainty. This also sort of contributes to this mixed messages Samantha earlier spoke about. I think it's sort of tends to weaken the West to some extent, it may also sort of irritate the Russians as they no longer sort of have a predictable contrarian in the West. So I think there's a certain kind of ambiguity about this whole situation now. It's very dangerous, I think, to some extent, but also maybe opens new opportunities to move this forward, because we've seen the Biden approach and also the Scholz approach hasn't really worked.
Peter Zamayev, just a quick closing word, because we're out of time on this.
Yes, once again, I wish I could be hopeful. I wish to be proven wrong. But so far, you know, we are dealing with a very we're in open waters, uncharted waters. Elon Musk that you just mentioned, you know, he's going to be in charge with Vivek Ramaswamy of this office, trying to cut down on America's bureaucracy. That would probably include the Pentagon. That will directly impact the war in Ukraine. So once again, we are going to be living in a brave new world, folks.
We'll have to leave it there, unfortunately. Peter Zamayev in Kyiv, thank you so much. I want to thank as well Henninghoff in Berlin, James J. Carafano in Washington, Samantha de Bentern, thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.